make two honest confessions to you, my Christian and Jewish brothers. First, I must confess that over the past few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white body. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's greatest stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate, who is devoted to order, who is devoted to more order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the absence of a positive peace, which is the presence of justice. Let me do that again. Who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice. Who constantly says, I agree with you in the goal that you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action. Who paternalistically believes he can set the timetable for another man's freedom. Who lives by a mythical concept of time, who constantly advises the Negro to wait for a more convenient moment. Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection. Good afternoon. My name is Amelia Sykes, and I am the state representative for the Birthplace of Champions, Ohio's 34th House District, and the Ohio House Minority Leader. The excerpt I just read was written by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on April 16, 1963, from a Birmingham jail. This letter also serves as the King Center featured writing for Dr. King's 91st birthday. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I am always honored when people offer me the opportunity to speak, and I certainly do not take these invitations lightly, especially this one in its 35th year. I've been coming to the MLK lecture series for a very long time, and I've heard some very wonderful commentary on Martin Luther King and his life, and it is certainly very humbling to be included in the list of men and women who have come before me today. I'd also like to extend a special thank you to the Akron Summit County Public Library and its Executive Director of Leadership, as well as the Eta Tau Lambda Chapter of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated for sponsoring this afternoon's event and for ensuring that the legacy of Dr. King lives on through events like this, as well as their service to the community. The organizers of this event gave me 45 minutes to talk. I assure you, I will not speak that long. But let's begin with a question. What is the American dream? Elected officials, candidates, political pundits, and commentators all talk about the American dream. But what is it? What is the American dream? Think about it for just a second. Marinate on the words. What does this phrase even mean? What does it mean to you? What does it mean to the person sitting next to you? You don't have to ask your neighbor. What does it mean to your partner, your children, your friends, your elected leaders? What is the American dream? And how does one achieve it? And why do elected officials and policymakers use this phrase so often? Well, I am certainly guilty of it too. In fact, we have a legislative framework that our caucus rolled out this past year. It's a 5-point plan called the Ohio Promise. It's a promise of better lives, brighter futures, and an economy that works for everyone. It is the lens by which we frame our policy work that says the promise of Ohio should be available for everyone to enjoy, and we have the legislative solutions to help realize that Ohio Promise. And guess what? The first part of the Ohio Promise says you can live the American dream right here at home, right here in Ohio. The concept of the American dream begins with the Declaration of Independence that says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The phrase American Dream has been credited to the historian James Truslow Adams, who first described the phrase in his 1931 book, The Epic of America. To Adams, the American Dream is that dream of a land in which life should be better and richer and fuller for everyone, with opportunity for each according to ability or achievement. He goes on further to say, it is not a dream of motor cars and high wages merely, but a dream of social order in which each man and each woman shall be able to attain to the fullest stature of which they are innately capable and be recognized by others for what they are, regardless of their fortuitous circumstances of birth or position. But how does one live or achieve the American dream in a country that was built on the work of enslaved people? A country that perpetuates a system of inequality in criminal justice, healthcare, education, employment, housing, and more. All of these systems that were created and designed with inequality in mind. The answer is, you don't. Not truly. You can't. Of course, there is no hard and fast rule, and there will always be exceptions, but the overall answer is the same. No one, not the oppressed nor the oppressor, can truly live the American dream when systems of oppression are in place. Or maybe you can. One of Dr. King's most famous speeches is, I have a dream. I don't need to recite it for you today, but Dr. King in that speech painted a hopeful and achievable standard that all Americans could realize the dream of this country, no matter who they are, who they were born to, or what zip code they lived in. Those words were spoken during the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in 1963. It's 2020. Have we achieved the dream Dr. King talked about? I'll leave that up to you to decide. I Have a Dream was delivered in August 1963, but in April of that year, Dr. King penned a letter from a Birmingham jail in response to members of clergy who criticized the organizing of peaceful protests in the city. In the open letter, the men deemed the protests that were led by Dr. King as unwise and untimely disruptions carried out by outsiders. The letter from a Birmingham jail serves as an interesting contrast to I Have a Dream, where just a few months earlier, Dr. King expressed his sincere frustration with the religious leaders who he believed would have been enthusiastically concerned about equality, fairness, freedom, and achieving the American dream for all citizens, whether they lived in Birmingham or Boise. Instead, their concern was about social order and patience. Dr. King talked a lot about the American dream throughout the years, even if he didn't use the phrase itself. But in February of 1964, Dr. King delivered a speech at Drew University called The American Dream. Dr. King begins the speech by saying, America is a dream, but a dream unfulfilled. In writing the Declaration of Independence, the Founding Fathers wrote that the dream of America was universal, but it will remain unfulfilled until America reconciles its ugly history of slavery and use of racial discrimination and segregation. The American dream, according to Dr. King, also included the need for government intervention, including progressive legislative actions. He noted that while morality cannot be legislated, behavior could be. He said, it might be true that the law cannot change the heart, but it can restrain the heartless. It may be true that the law cannot make a man love me, but it can keep him from lynching me. The purpose of my comments today is to talk about my work in office as a legislator and how it reflects Dr. King's vision and dream. I have placed at the forefront of my legislative agenda to create an environment for meaningful employment opportunities. Local jobs for local workers, quality education, safe neighborhoods, accessibility to affordable and quality health care and wellness, eliminating health disparities, and closing the shameful racial disparities that exist in infants and maternal mortality. passed bills that designated awareness months for teen dating violence and adoption, bills that provided compensation to those who have been wrongfully imprisoned. And I authored a piece of legislation for the previous General Assembly, House Bill 1, a bill to protect victims of dating violence. But despite all of my time and attention to my community, the needs of this great state, the office hours of the town halls, the amendments offered, drafted, and tabled, floor speeches, millions of dollars of capital improvements, and funding to start the infant mortality programs that have grown into a community pathway hub and a major initiative of the city working to lower infant deaths. However, despite all of that, one of the most significant moments in my legislative career started with this letter that I wrote to read as follows. Dear Sergeant at Arms Lay, I am writing because I am looking for clarification of the new State House security policies. On more than one occasion, I have followed the memo in regards to the State House policies as it relates to members of the General Assembly and staff, but I am regularly stopped, questioned, and told I needed my personal effects to be searched. It was my understanding that by showing a State House ID and my legislator pin, I would not have to walk through the security detectors or need to have my bag searched. However, on several occasions after showing both, the Highway Patrol insisted on searching my handbag. On one particularly frustrating encounter, another colleague of mine came to my defense and shared with the Highway Patrol officer that I too was a legislator and asked why I couldn't go through as he did without being searched. The Highway Patrol officer still insisted that my bag be searched anyway. When I questioned him as to why I needed to be searched and asked to go through the metal detectors, but my fellow member was not required to do the same, I was told, "You don't look like a legislator." The incident described above was not the first nor the last time that I have been asked to be searched or show every credential I have in order to bypass the security process. At this point, I am looking for clarification as to what else I need to do to come and go to my place of work without the additional scrutiny that other members of the General Assembly or staff have to deal with. Many times I have seen lobbyists, staff, and others come through the same doors I do, but when I walk around the metal sensor, I am stopped, questioned, and asked, "What are you doing?" While every time I come through the State House doors is not like this, the regularity leaves me uncertain with what type of shakedown I will receive when trying to get to committee or to session. I certainly appreciate the need for extra security in these changing and difficult times, and I believe that I have been patient, and I have changed my own behavior to be more accommodating to the Highway Patrol officers that protect us daily. However, it is becoming more difficult for me to simply brush this off as transitional hiccups. We have had this new policy for close to 3 months, and I do not want to have any negative encounters with the people who are here to protect me and the citizens who come into the People's House. Thank you in advance for any help that you can offer with this matter, and I look forward to hearing from you soon. That letter, written in February 2016, came with a response ensuring that my security experience would be better with time, and a suspicion that perhaps the troopers I encountered were new and did not know the protocol. We both know, all of us in this room know, that is not true. A year and a half later, and yet another unfortunate security incident in a viral tweet, my American dream began to feel much more like the frustration of the letter from a Birmingham jail, rather than the hopefulness of the "I Have a Dream" speech on Washington for jobs and for freedom. The idea that me, Amelia, the duly elected state representative from the 34th House District, albeit just the third black member from Summit County at the time, could continue to encounter these negative situations when I was simply trying to get to work on behalf of my community was not and could not be the dream that Dr. King hoped for. It wasn't the dream that my parents, friends, family, or constituents had hoped for either. I certainly was not naive to the challenges of the job when I started. I never thought that my education or my title would protect me from having to work harder or smarter than my colleagues to get anything accomplished. Because at the end of the day, I'm still Black, I'm still a woman, I'm still young. But I never imagined that trying to walk into a building reserved for the business of the people, the people's house, would lead me to filing civil rights complaints against some of the state's highest-ranking officials and agencies. The work that I do in office is just as much about policy and constituent services as it is an act of nonviolent resistance. My presence is an act of nonviolent resistance. Protest to the people and systems who don't believe that the American dream includes Black women legislators. And it's not that it's my American dream to hold or be in elected office, but it should be the dream of everyone to appreciate that the face of leadership is not just made up of white males. That Black women across the country serve our communities every day and do so exceptionally well, with unnecessary obstacles placed by closed-minded folks who want to protect and maintain the status quo. With the help of a few allies, I started the We Belong Here movement to bring attention to these issues and uplift the work and tenacity of Black women in public service. Women who are often viewed as outsiders, unqualified to sit at tables where significant decisions are being made. Women who decided not to remain silent about racial biases at any level. Women willing to tell their stories in order to create a collective voice for change. We continue to proclaim, we belong here. We belong everywhere. We belong everywhere we want to be. We belong here. Over the next few months, you'll hear and see We Belong Here more often, not only as a rallying cry, but as the movement shifts to the next level towards engagement and support of women who simply want to serve our communities. If I can be honest, the work that I do sometimes feels much more reflective of the frustration that Dr. King expressed in his letter from a Birmingham jail, being viewed as an outsider that should just wait and never rock the boat, rather than the hope and optimism in I Have a Dream, where everyone having a chance to shape our communities is the optimal outcome. Yet and still, part of the reason we can't realize fully the American dream is that because some people like me, are viewed as being unworthy and don't belong in the stories of success and freedom that Dr. King dreamed of. I find it astonishing that this time, every year, politicians, some of them my colleagues, take to their keyboards or stand up in rooms like this and acknowledge the work of Dr. King. They laud him for his nonviolent movement and his quest for peace and understanding one's neighbor, all while pushing segregationist educational and housing policies, restricting access to the ballot box, limiting access to quality and affordable health care, undermining social safety net programs, promoting war and conflicts in nations across the world, all while promoting discriminatory policies that keep people from being gainfully employed and perpetuating socioeconomic underclasses to provide services to those who have been able to achieve the American dream, only because these systems have kept wages and life expectancy low and the American dream impossible for others to attain. They quote lines from the I Have a Dream speech like, "One day I hope my children will live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character." But they ignore in that very speech, Dr. King said, that there will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his full citizenship rights. Or we'll hear uplifting and unifying quotes of, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, but fail to recognize that in that same speech included this line, Freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. Hypocrisy of celebrating Dr. King, but only cherry-picking the words that are advantageous to a narrative that further oppresses marginalized people, does little to preserve the legacy of a man who lost his life advancing the American dream. When Dr. King died, he was not popular. He was not applauded for his work. The tension that his movement brought to the surface was unwanted and expressed from people in all walks of life, including open letters from fellow members of the clergy. But his bravery lives on through, hopefully, my work and the efforts and work of other people in this room. My comments today were to reflect on my work in office, and hopefully it advances the values and legacy of Dr. King. Hopefully I did that in this lecture, and hopefully I do that in my work. I hope my words shared my passion for equality, fairness, health equity, livable wages, collective bargaining, and the fight for jobs and freedom. The urgency of now and the dignity of humanity and respect for all work. And that as much as someone like me accomplishes, there still remains a need for us to proclaim that I belong here and that we belong here. Perhaps more than any other expression that I've read from Dr. King to date that reflects the work that I do is a sermon Dr. King delivered on July 4th, 1965 at the Ebenezer Baptist Church, a church that I joined while living in Atlanta after law school. That's how my pastor walked up and told him. I didn't want him to know I joined this church. But a church that I joined after law school because I believed in the social justice ministry of my Christian experience. Dr. King preached the words to his congregation of an American dream that had turned into a nightmare. Dreams that were now shattered due to the devastation, heartache, and disappointment of the last 2 years of stagnation towards racial equality and freedom for people across this country. The nightmare and shattered dreams of poverty that not only existed for blacks, but also of whites in Appalachia. But he closes the sermon saying, he still has a dream. He still had a dream that truth will reign supreme and all of God's children will respect the dignity and worth of human personality. And when this day comes, the morning stars will sing together and the sons of God will shout for joy. Thank you for listening.
As I said earlier, you would have a chance to submit a question to be answered by Leader Sykes, and we have people distributing postcards on both sides of the auditorium. So please raise your hand if you'd like one, and then we'll be collecting those as well. But to get us started, I wanted to ask Leader Sykes, what advice would you give to young people, particularly those of color, who are interested in someday running for office?
Thank you, and thank you for that question. My advice would be to just do it. I know that I talked a bit about how challenging it has been for me, and it certainly has been challenging, but it is certainly more rewarding and has been more rewarding to serve my community. And so if anyone is considering running, especially if you are a woman, or especially if you are a person of color, and if you're both, just do it. We need you in these spaces. We need you in these places to share your experiences, what it's like to live on the margins, and how the work that you can do can not only lift up the communities from which you come, but communities all across our state and our country.
I'm curious, because I don't have any questions yet, could you share with us a little bit about how soon you knew you wanted to run for office, and did you hold office in in any of your schooling, your educational experiences?
Thank you for that. So the truth is, I never wanted to be an elected member in any capacity. Not city council, not mayor, not state rep, not any of it. I actually was a part of student council in middle school. I was middle school president, the student body president in high school. I was a part of student council, also the president there. And I enjoyed it, and I loved it, and I thought it was a great fun. But to take that work into the community and outside of the school was a little bit more than I was willing to do. I had always been encouraged by public service. I've watched my parents, Vernon and Barbara Sykes, who you all know and love as much as I do. I saw the work that they did, and I saw it was hard. And that people didn't really appreciate you for the work that you did. And people would come up to us in this grocery store and fuss and yell, and sometimes a little startling and a lot of bit uncomfortable. But after a while, I started to recognize how important it is to have people who care, particularly in communities like mine that has its challenges, to step up and run for office. And so at the time, so I had moved to Georgia and Alabama and Florida and all these other places and thought this was the best way for me to never have to run for office. But it obviously didn't work very well. So that's what happens when you make your own plans, so don't do that. I saw when my dad was term limited that there were people interested in running for office, and good people, but not people who I thought would have cared about the community that raised my sister and I the way that they deserved to be treated. And so it became my responsibility to take care of that community, and so I ran for office. And so while my initial thoughts were to never be here, just goes to show how wrong I was.
Question from the audience. Do you see a policy opportunity at the State House to respond to the need that will emerge from the federal changes in the SNAP program?
Not really. What we could do is create more opportunities for folks to be gainfully employed. We could eliminate the types of attacks on collective bargaining and unions so that when folks do get positions, they are well-paid, they have livable wages. With the SNAP benefits, unfortunately, people view social services and social security nets as entitlements that people aren't really entitled to. And we all pay our taxes, whether it's a sales tax or a property tax. We all pay them. We're paying into these entities and to these programs so that in the event that we need them, we can use them. And so to discuss them as though people are taking advantage of it is not only wrong, it's incorrect, and it's mean. It's mean-spirited. And so if we're not creating jobs here in the state of Ohio so people are they don't need those types of services, we're not really advancing the needs of our community. But for those people who do need them, which is an overwhelming majority of children and elderly and disabled, I would hope that at the state level and at the federal level, people would be much more considerate about what it means when you say people shouldn't have access to food, that it's okay for them to go hungry, that they should just pull themselves up from their bootstraps, because I don't think that's good anymore.
Given the super Republican majority of the state house, how do you balance the need to compromise with the desire or want for progressive, even radical change?
So that's a case-by-case study, and it depends on the issue. I will say this and preface my comments with, there are some issues that I will not ever compromise on. Issues related to racial disparities or gender disparities or the rights of certain people to live freely through our communities, those are things that cannot be compromised, and I will not compromise. Where we can, it just really takes a conversation and the willingness to put yourself out there and figure out where we do find some opportunities to agree. There's some interesting information, some statistics we talked about in this last year, that our caucus, although we are in the super minority, has been able to advance legislation in just a year, substantive legislation, more in this last year than in the 4 years combined. And we've done that because of the philosophy in the back, who's clapping. because of work like from Representative Galanski, my colleague from the 35th House District, but because there's an overall willingness from the members of our caucus that our people cannot afford for us just to fight, just to be fighting. We have to figure out a way to move the needles on some of these issues. And you'll find as you sit and talk to these members, and some from all over the state and cities that I've never even seen, and if you asked me to find it on the map, I couldn't do it. But we all have some of the same foundational wants, which is for our families to be taken care of, our communities to be safe, for us to want to be happy and live the American dream, quite frankly. And so as long as we are willing to take the time and do the work that it takes, we can get that compromise. And we've done that, we've been very successful, and we will continue to do that for the remainder of the year.
How do you think we can build greater relationships among the Black, LGBTQ, and all other minorities?
So I'm going to take the question assuming that building relationships amongst each other, is that what that seems to be?
I think it's as groups. How can there be greater relationships between these various minorities?
Well, I think that, again, it just takes the conversation of saying, what do you need? And let me tell you what I need. And we'll figure out where our needs are combined, and we'll go forth together. Now, perhaps there are some differences that we should be willing to work on behalf of our sisters and brothers so that everyone can realize their opportunities, their full opportunities, without being minimized or oppressed. But again, we have to be willing to talk to one another and be willing to be vulnerable and share and then do the work, because it is a lot of work to put yourself out there and challenge systems that have been in place for hundreds of years to do something different. And even when we do challenge them and we fail, because you do, you won't win the first time, just to keep going and to keep adding more people. And eventually, they're not going to be able to say no.
Another audience member would like to know, what has been your most rewarding experience since you've been in office?
To pick just one is really, really hard. But I will say that one of the best opportunities I had was I was actually wearing this exact same suit when the governor signed House Bill 1 into law. That was a bill that was a labor of love. It took 4 years to get done. Now, in legislative years, it's not that long. But in introducing a bill that a colleague of mine in our freshman year introduced because we thought it was a good idea, but ultimately was going to get picked up by the Republicans because it was such a good idea, and they would never give us the credit, was simply amazing. And it was an opportunity and not only because it was for me personally and as a professional, but because my colleagues in the House, as well as my colleagues in the Senate, Republicans and Democrats, all voted and supported this bill to make sure that we were protecting a vulnerable segment of our community. And so it gave me a little bit of hope that we could continue to do that work. Now, I know we don't always do it, and you probably see in the news when we don't get along very well, but it was an example of what happens when you work hard and you just keep trying and you keep building and keep adding and you persevere through all of the challenges because some things are just worth it. It's worth the effort. And so that was, if I have to pick one, because I've had very many, it's been a great job. I'm not saying that just because it's an election year. It was really rewarding.
Again, an audience member would like to know, and has commented that we all hear the argument that our vote is insignificant and unimportant. Can you provide a counter-argument for those kinds of statements?
If our votes were insignificant, not counted, or unimportant, there wouldn't be an active, systemic, and ongoing fight to keep you from voting.
What can you say, and thereby what could we say, to encourage the millennial and Gen X communities to vote?
hard question because I'm a millennial and I've voted every single election. I don't think I could have come back home if I didn't vote in every single election. And so it was instilled in me in a way that most people don't get the pleasure of luxury of having. But what I feel we don't do well as elected leaders and sometimes community leaders or just friends or neighbors is communicate that the decisions being made by people like me are really important. And there's not a single thing that you do that does not touch public policy. The car that you got in, the reason why there's seatbelts in your car, the reason why the speed limit is what it is, the reason why the potholes are filled or not, those are all decisions being made by someone like me. And if you don't want to pick that person, someone else will pick it for you. And for some reason, we haven't been able to connect the dots between these really important issues because politics and elected office seems like a nebulous thing. And I go to work in Columbus, and then I show back up, and you know, some people know what I'm doing, and some people don't know what I'm doing. But we have to, as elected officials particularly, spend a lot more time educating the people that we serve about our work. And if you find that we're not doing it, you got to say it to us, you aren't doing good enough, you're not doing well enough in this education. Because once we start to make people understand how helpful or harmful certain people in certain positions can be, and not just the president or Congress, because they get a lot of lip service and they take up a lot of space, but your city council people, your county council people, and your mayors and state representatives, we are all making very important decisions every day on incredibly basic things, everyday things. And you have to want to ensure people who care about what you care about are there making those decisions for you. So to answer the question again and succinctly is just we have to connect the dots, and it's going to take some time. And we have to make it plain, we have to make it clear, and we have to bring it to people where they are, not where we are. So that might make us a little uncomfortable. Especially those of us used to being dressed up and everything and not want to go to communities we're not used to, we have to stop all of that. If we really want people to vote, if we want people to be engaged, we have to meet them where they are and talk to them in the way that they like to be talked to.
A Stand Your Ground proposal is currently in discussion in the legislature. What is your view on this proposal? And what are the odds of its passing?
So I'm going to tell a story about Stand Your Ground. I am my daughter's child. Let me tell you a story. Last year or so, during lame duck session, we were discussing Stand Your Ground. And it was just like any other floor session, and we were kind of battling it out, one in which we weren't agreeing. We had the Democrats on one side making our arguments, Republicans on the other side making their arguments. And a colleague of mine from Cleveland stood up. She had her handwritten notes because she only ever handwrites her notes. And she started to list all of the sponsors of the bill and the percentage of African American or black people who live there. And she went through the numbers. 2%. Next group. 1%. Next group. 3.4%. And the speaker started to gavel her. He wanted her to stop talking. And she wouldn't. And so she went through the list a little bit more. House district, fill in the blank, 6%. House district that, 4%. And the speaker picked up his gavel and he and said, Representative, you are out of order. In that encounter, and Representative Blonsky, I know, remembers it well, our colleague refused to back down. And she continued to say, this is important. We have to talk about how Stand Your Ground impacts communities of color in a way that these representatives do not understand. That situation did not end well. The speaker at that point decided to cut off her microphone, silencing that member and her constituents because it was not desired to hear the realities of Stand Your Ground, what it means to communities across the state. And the part that you probably did not read, did not see, was that the sergeant-at-arms was sent to do something to her. I don't know why they were sent to her, but certainly the sergeant-at-arms is a law enforcement member that carries a gun. It was a moment that made it very clear why Sandra Brown should never rear its ugly face in the state. But members of the General Assembly continue to push it without thinking fully or thoughtfully or sincerely about what it means for certain communities, communities like mine, communities like this one, the one that I represent. And so, unfortunately, I can't tell you that Sandra Brown will pass in Ohio. I can't tell you that. I wish I could. But I will tell you that if you don't want Sandra Brown to pass in the state, you need to tell somebody. And it's not me, because I already know. It's not Rick Belonsky. It's not Senator Sykes. But you need to let the people who lead this state know that Stand Your Ground is not something that you want here. And explain to them what it means when someone can shoot first and ask questions later. You don't get to come back from those kinds of decisions. And so it is, I believe it has a hearing next week in committee. Call the committee chair. Call the members of that committee. Look at their voting record. I would recommend, instead of calling the ones who have the same beliefs as you, and you may be for Stand Your Ground, you may be against it, call the ones who are against it and see if they would be willing to listen to your perspective, and perhaps you can change their hearts or you can change their minds.
Thank you. As you have worked to rise to the level of achievement that you have achieved, that you've reached, what has been your greatest adversity, and how did you overcome that adversity?
My greatest adversity always has been, and probably will continue to be, people who don't think I should be in the places that I am in. I unfortunately spend a lot of time explaining things like, oh no, I'm Representative Sykes. We don't have to wait for the representative to come in, because I'm here. And it takes away from my ability, not because my skill set is low, but we don't have a lot of time. We heard the conversation about how much time we have, and if I have to spend half of my time trying to let people know who I am, that I'm supposed to be here, that we've wasted the time to talk about the things that matter. And so every single time that this happens, I just continue to think that I could get so much more done, we could get so much more done, if we didn't have to go through this step every single time. We could really be much more effective. And if I were to count it all out, it's probably hours or days of explaining and explanations. And yes, I went to law school. No, I didn't go to that law school. Yes, I actually graduated from high school. And yes, I'm old enough to vote. No, my dad doesn't tell me how to vote on everything. On and on and on and on. It would be much more effective. I could be much more effective. And those roadblocks, they get harder and harder. And I'll say this before I turn the mic back over. You know, Shirley Chisholm talks often about, if they don't give you a seat at the table, you bring them a folding chair. And sometimes that might not even be enough, because we are going to have to start building our own tables and inviting people to have the luxury to sit at our table.
Three more questions. What laws are being or have been changed recently that impact women's rights in Ohio? And what are your goals or contributions to positively impact women's rights, or your intended goals?
So unfortunately, we haven't had a lot of laws that positively impact women's rights here in the state of Ohio. We had a bill, the six-week abortion ban, which would negatively impact the rights of women to choose what is best for them, for their families, and to have pure agency over themselves. And so my colleagues, the majority of my colleagues, I would say, continue to perpetuate and push these bills because I don't think that they think we know what we're doing as women. But they need to tell us what to do. But they need to decide our fates, and what happens in our bodies, and what happens to our bodies. And when somebody takes away or makes the decision to take away that kind of agency from you, I don't know how you succeed here in this state. And so I know we've introduced all kinds of bills. I'm actually working on a bill right now, and I haven't introduced any bills because I'm a leader, and being the leader makes it very hard to shepherd a piece of legislation through, but it is to support women and look at the status of women and how we can continue to promote and push and advance over half of our population in the state. So you'll see a lot of work from some members of the legislature. We will continue to try to make sure women have a fair and equitable standing in our state, but most of that won't change until the faces of our leadership changes and we have more women in office who can talk about the needs, and we have the majority and we can vote for the things that we want and need, because we can't always rely on our brothers, sorry y'all, to help us. Really, you should be apologizing to us.
And I'm sorry, I was mistaken. We have a few more.
That's okay.
Keep going. Since Summit County has some of the highest rates in the United States of infant and maternal mortality among the African-American population, what interventions at the state level can lower those rates?
So an intervention that would work at the state level as well as throughout this community and communities in this nation is to consider the systemic disparities that exist, particularly for women of color, black women, when they enter into healthcare systems, when they enter into education systems, when they enter into their employers' offices. Racism kills. Racism kills. It has literally been killing people from the beginning of time. Racism kills. And it's not that race is the risk factor, it is racism. It is the fact that certain people believe that if you have a face as dark as mine, I deserve less treatment, poor treatment, mediocre treatment. And that kills people. It is literally killing people. And for some reason, it's hard for someone to want to accept those words. And I can get it, because people don't feel like they are racist or that they're trying to do anything wrong or negative, but they are. I mean, how many of you, when I walked up here, thought, hey, that's not the representative. That's not her. Where's the real one coming? And those little biases and those thoughts that go unchecked are the reasons why women die in childbirth and through their pregnancies and after their pregnancies. And it's the reason why our most vulnerable citizens, our infants up to the age of one, cannot survive. They cannot survive racism. So let's talk about it like that. They cannot survive racism. And so a speech like today's, and talking about Dr. Martin Luther King and his quest for racial fairness and equity, was not just simply for jobs and housing, it was for life, survival. People cannot live like this. The chronic stress brought on by racism literally kills people. It changes your systems. Lots of inflammation. Racism kills. And so if we ever really want to address infant mortality or maternal mortality, we have to talk about race. And I'll say this one quick story. We introduced a Black Maternal Health Caucus this year. It's the first one in the nation. And it's to address issues around maternal health specific to Black women. And we know that it was going to be a little controversial, because in time we highlight and focus and uplift Black women, people say, well, what about all women? Well, all women are having the same problems that Black women are having, and all women are dying from racism. So I had a meeting not too long ago, and this person was talking about the work that they were doing and how they wanted to work with the Maternal Health Caucus, because the Maternal Health Caucus had such great things. And the Maternal Health Caucus could really use a friend like them. And I had to stop them, and I said, it is not the Maternal Health Caucus. It is the Black Maternal Health Caucus. And you have to get it right. Do not just say Maternal Health Caucus. And so, of course, it went through, but that's not what I meant. I really meant, I knew. I said, no, you don't know. Because you just erased the need for even creating this by just calling it the Maternal Health Caucus. And it happens all the time. And that's why Black women and Black infants are dying. So we have to talk about it. We have to uplift it. We can't hide from it. We have to be uncomfortable. It's the only way we get it done.
Do Do you see any movement on improving the Ohio earned income tax credit, for instance, making it refundable, in particular for a more meaningful safety net policy?
I sure hope so. We've been pushing it for a while. The earned income tax is the greatest anti-poverty proposal that this country has ever seen. In Ohio, we have implemented one and even expanded it, but it's not refundable. So it really doesn't do what it's intended to do. And so we will continue to push our colleagues who do believe in tax refunds for things like having a private jet. We should give it to some working class families, or, you know, we have tax incomes for these LLC loopholes. If you make over $250,000 a year, you don't even have to pay taxes on your income. We're not talking about people like that. We're talking about people who really could use an extra $50, an extra $100 in their check, or a refund that was a couple thousand dollars they could put a down payment on an apartment. So they could move, put a safety deposit in so they don't get evicted, or they could pay their rent or their groceries or get their kids into a daycare so they could get to work. Those are the things that make a big difference. And we'll continue to push it. Right now, we don't have enough members in the House or the Senate who want to do that. But again, it is an election year, and you can change anything that you want so long as you vote. But not vote me out. That's not the top
part. What advice do you have for brown children when addressing strained or racially motivated situations? You spoke to the Highway Patrol about your concerns and your treatment. What can these children do?
For children, well, let me say it this way. You know, it is not easy to stand up for yourself, especially when there are organizations of authority, especially those who have, in some instances, been created to oppress you. And so for children especially, the ability to have that type of poise would be incredible for them to do it. But if they don't, which, you know, most people don't, even adults, I would suggest find some friends and some allies to stand up with you. It's so much easier to do things with other people than it is to do it alone. And if you can make your case or just speak up for yourself, you will always feel better for it. I don't think there's ever been a time that I've ever regretted saying something than I have been when I did not say something, especially when it was for my own needs and my own wants and desires. And so I would encourage these children or the child or the parent who asked that question on behalf of their child to stand up for themselves, to feel confident in themselves, and to find a friend or a neighbor or a parent or a teacher to stand with them so they don't have to go at it alone.
All right, another question from the audience. This person wrote, "We have judges in Summit County who ask everyone who comes before them, 'Are you a citizen of the United States?' Can you comment on how uncomfortable this makes undocumented immigrants in our community?"
Well, I would imagine that it makes them incredibly uncomfortable to go before an official government body to be asked that question, not knowing whether your truthful or not so truthful answer will get you deported. And if it is not a question that is legally required, I'm not sure why the judges are. I unfortunately don't know the answer to that question at this moment, but I could find it out. But people who live in the United States who are undocumented are still people too. And sometimes folks forget that. And they deserve to be treated with dignity and humanity, even if they are illegally here or even illegally entered the country. There's not a single person in this room who has not broken some type of law, intentionally or unintentionally. And to place that kind of judgment on someone who decided they wanted a better life for themselves and their family, which would make them so uncomfortable that they don't access justice, is disgraceful.
Here's a question motivated from concern for you. What can your constituents do to alert whomever we need to of our desire to see you treated with the respect that other legislators receive when you try to enter your offices?
Well, thank you for that question. And I am always so, so, so thankful for my community. talk about our districts and what separates them, I came up with the birthplace of champions. And it was really a way to honor the people who selected me to be their leader. And I'm always grateful because you've always given me the opportunity to be myself, to take chances and risks. And I'll never be able to thank you enough for that. So to answer that question, I was doing so well. I always cry in speeches. So if I ever write that, I'm going to meet you out in the back. But what you can do is just continue to let me know if there's something that I'm doing well, even if there's something I'm doing not so well, because I truly want to be the best representative for you. My community, this community, is one we should be very proud of. I'm proud of it. I'm proud to be from it. And everybody in Columbus knows it. And I do that because you deserve it. Your kids deserve it. Your neighbors deserve it. This community deserves it. And so I really feel like I don't deserve the love that you give. You know that I'm doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing. I am exactly where I'm supposed to be, and I know that I belong here, and I belong in this place, no matter what I try to do, I know where I'm going.
Is an offer of assistance. You declared January as National Slavery and Human Trafficking Month. The staggering amount of Ohio affected is quite alarming. How can I get involved on a personal level?
So I'm going to send you to Representative Golanski. Wave your hand, Rep. Golanski. So Representative Golanski represents and leads our Women's Caucus, but every year she hosts a human trafficking event at the State House where she and other members bring together experts and our colleagues and policymakers and law enforcement to talk about the needs of those who are being human trafficked. It is a wonderful event. They've been doing it for almost 6 or 7 years now. 12, my goodness. So 12 years now. That before she got there, before I got there. But it has grown and it continues to grow. And it will only do that if there are more people being engaged. And so I'm going to send you to Rep. Golanski, who is in the back, to talk a little bit more how you personally can be involved, because I think she's probably got some better answers than I do.
Once again, thank you.